Let's talk about balance, not the mythical kind, but the kind that you actually build day to day. That's why I recommend Oakstone CME to my colleagues. It's designed to fit into your routine and not disrupt it. Their content, like the Mix App Audio Companion, is broken into snackable modules that make it incredibly easy to chip away at CME while walking your dog, driving home, or just taking vibe. You don't have to carve out time. You just need to hit play. And what's so great is that you're not just earning credits, CME credits, but it's also learning that actually sticks. So you can feel confident in your knowledge and still have time left for other things in your life. So whether you're looking to stay sharp, improve patient care, or just looking at CME off your to-do list and do it without tipping the balance, check out oakstone.com/mixapp. Use the code CORE25 for actually 25% off. This is exclusive to Core AM listeners. So go to oakstone.com/MKSAP and don't forget to use the code CORE25.
I always found the pathogenesis fascinating as a medical student and resident. I always reading about it, how the failure of one organ ended up affecting the kidneys. And then I started as a fellow seeing patients and consults and realized how tough those consults were and how my attendings were also struggling. And it was just such a high degree of uncertainty, which led me to start reading more and more and more about it and became one of my clinical area of interest.
That's Dr. Juan Carlos Velez, a nephrologist at Ochsner Health.
Hi, I am Juan Carlos Velez. I am a nephrologist at Ochsner Health in New Orleans.
Welcome to the Core IM 5 Pearls podcast, bringing you high-yield evidence-based pearls. I'm Dr. Shreya Trivedi, and I'm joined by...
Hi, I am Dr. Noah Markowitz, a PGY3 internal medicine resident at Montefiore in the Bronx.
Today's episode is all things hepatorenal syndrome, or HRS-AKI. And yes, we're going to be referring to hepatorenal syndrome as HRS. Noah and I debated about this so much, and I was like, no, we have to call it hepatorenal syndrome. But now I'm a full convert, and hepatorenal is just a mouthful to say. So you're going to be hearing us say HRS a lot.
So this will be a two-part episode. Today, we'll be talking all about diagnosis of HRS, and next week, we'll be all about treatment. Let's talk about the five pearls we'll be covering today.
Remember, the more you test yourself, the deeper your learning gains.
Pearl 1, pathophysiology of HRS.
What are the hormonal changes during cirrhosis that make our patients more susceptible to hepatorenal syndrome?
Pearl 2, differential diagnosis.
How do you approach the differential in a patient with cirrhosis who has AKI?
Pearl 3, all about sodium.
How do you use serum and urine sodium to help us with the differential of AKI in a patient with cirrhosis?
Pearl 4, the official diagnosis.
How do you actually diagnose hepatorenal syndrome?
Pearl 5, all about albumin.
Is that 48-hour albumin challenge always necessary to diagnose HRS?
The first thing for us to really appreciate for HRS is to shift our brains not to think in terms of cirrhosis, but to think in terms of portal hypertension.
Yeah. And so if we need to really shift our focus to portal hypertension, then let's quickly remind ourselves how that portal hypertension develops.
Cirrhosis itself is actually just the scarring of the liver. So the more the scarring and inflammation or fat, any of those kinds of combination of things, depending on which kind of liver disease you have, the more that that happens, the more that blood can't get through the liver, the higher the venous pressures are in your abdomen, and you start to build up portal hypertension. And so patients usually don't present until either somebody notices something weird on imaging or they have a complication of portal hypertension. And then typically the most common complication of portal hypertension is ascites, which is where that pressure builds up so much that, you know, you start to leak the fluid into the peritoneal cavity.
That is Dr. Nick Mazumder, a hepatologist from the University of Michigan.
My name is Nick Mazumder. I'm one of the transplant hepatologists here at University of Michigan. My interests are in portal hypertension and the complications and physiology therein, and using that to better treat our liver patients and get them better.
Once someone develops portal hypertension, it's the body's hormonal response that creates an environment that makes my favorite needle-little organs, the kidneys, so susceptible.
So you start with a cirrhotic liver, sort of a stiffness, liver stiffness that leads to increased intrahepatic vascular resistance that this process of a hypertensive kind of liver and stiff liver leads to a maladaptive response outside the liver that is kind of the opposite. So there's a maladaptive vasodilation peripherally in this blood circulation and other vascular beds, mostly driven by release of nitric oxide. So nitric oxide is kind of absent inside the hepatic sinusoid and becomes very prominent outside to try to fight this liver cirrhosis state. And as a result, you get this peripheral vasodilation. So that is going to kind of start sending a signal to your baroreceptors that control vascular tone to say, okay, we got to fix that. So we're going to activate a sympathetic nervous system. And we know that the sympathetic nervous system has its own mediators, but also activates beta-adrenergic receptors, the renin-angiotensin system. So you also get the renin-angiotensin system amplified, and both the sympathetic and renin-angiotensin system are going to lead to this state of trying to reabsorb sodium and water in vasoconstrict vascular beds.
So to recap, because of the stiffness in the liver, the body initially tries to compensate by vasodilating. This vasodilation leads to a state of low effective circulatory volume. So even though the body is total body volume up, what the kidney's actually sensing is low perfusion. So what the kidney will do in response is use the RAS system to vasoconstrict.
And of course, your favorite organ, the kidney, is just an innocent bystander to that whole cascade that's leading to vasoconstriction.
Also in the 70s, did some crazy stuff. It transplanted a hepatorenal syndrome kidney into another person after the patient with cirrhosis died, and the kidney worked great. So, you know, a lot of these things tell us that the kidney itself is kind of working. It's normal. It's just not getting the blood flow, and it's because of this weird physiology in hepatorenal syndrome.
These studies are fascinating. One study that I really loved looked at the angiography of a patient with hepatorenal syndrome. Nothing was perfused through the renal artery. And then on autopsy, once the vasoconstriction was no longer at play, when they did the same angiography, the flow was perfect. The kidney's completely normal. We'll put a really cool picture of this in our show notes.
Yeah, it is really neat to see. But again, this all reiterates to me the kidney, again, is an innocent bystander to all that vasoconstriction from the hormonal cascade that's causing all this problem. The kidney itself is fine, and it all starts with that awful portal hypertension.
You know, Shreya, that reminds me. I see a lot of patients who happen to have cirrhosis in their one-liner, and when they get an AKI, I kind of cringe when I read the note, and under the problem of AKI, the note says, hepatorenal syndrome? Question mark?
I've seen those.
Yeah, it's all the time. And I'm like, they have compensated cirrhosis. They don't have complications from their cirrhosis. And so without that portal hypertension, this is not HRS. Our final expert, Dr. Marina Serper, a hepatologist from the University of Pennsylvania, will really drive this point home for us.
Hi, I'm Marina Serper. I am a hepatologist at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have compensated cirrhosis for whatever reason, let's say you had hepatitis C and you were treated, you've removed the etiology of liver disease, but you have stable cirrhosis, you can live in that state for 10 years and nothing would happen. You don't have to be predisposed to hepatorenal syndrome because you don't have necessarily portal hypertension. You don't have worsening of your liver.
So Noah, you and Dr. Serber are saying that if we have a patient who has stable cirrhosis, who has no evidence of portal hypertension on exam, no ascites on their POCUS, by definition, they cannot have hepatorenal syndrome because it's the portal hypertension that's really kicking off this whole cascade.
Exactly. The key way I like to reframe HRS is that it is not AKI on cirrhosis, but rather AKI on portal hypertension.
I like the ring of that.
Yeah, so you cannot have HRS without evidence of worsening portal hypertension. It's the portal hypertension that matters, not the cirrhosis.
Awesome. And maybe just to draw that connection a little bit more, I'm thinking about patients that come in acute liver failure. So these patients, these things are happening so fast, they don't have time to develop portal hypertension that's going to kick off that whole cascade to even lead to hepatorenal syndrome.
Yeah, so the next time you see someone with Tylenol toxicity causing acute liver failure in the ICU, if they have an AKI, that's usually ATN. That is not hepatorenal syndrome.
Yeah, they didn't have enough time for portal hypertension to develop and kick off that whole cascade. That would even lead to hepatorenal syndrome. Maybe the last thing to kind of close out the section on important pathophys grounding. I just had such a big aha when we learned about why we don't give NSAIDs to patients with portal hypertension.
Here we're talking about prostaglandins. NSAIDs work essentially by blocking the production of prostaglandins.
Yeah. And then as a reminder, in hepatorenal syndrome, we have all this vasoconstriction happening. And so our patients are really relying on that prostaglandins to fight it as much as possible to keep the vessel open.
And this is why patients with cirrhosis are so dependent on those prostaglandins kind of fighting the situation. And this is why if you give an NSAID to a patient with cirrhosis, it's like bad news because they are in such a high prostaglandin state to defend themselves against a high catecholamine Ang-2 state that the minute you drop a prostaglandin inhibitor, you essentially shut down renal circulation and go into an AKI faster than anybody else.
To summarize Pearl 1, cirrhosis is just a stiff liver. And when we think about hepatorenal syndrome, the physiology here is that because the liver is so stiff, the body's initially going to try and vasodilate. What the vasodilation does, the kidney's sensing low effective circulating volume. What that's going to do is it's going to cause the kidney to turn on the RAS system and vasoconstrict, and the kidney is extremely susceptible to that vasoconstriction. We have good evidence to show that if we can reverse that vasoconstriction, the kidney will wake back up.
That's awesome. And I think is that we should really be thinking about hepatorenal syndrome, not as something that can happen if someone has compensated cirrhosis, but it's really going to be in a patient who's developing an AKI on portal hypertension, as the lovely future nephrologist Noah says. All right, so now let's use that pathophys to get into the differential, right? So you have a patient who comes in with a creatinine bump who has cirrhosis. How do we unpack what is driving that AKI?
They teach us that it's 85% of the time the diagnosis is in the history, and it applies to cirrhosis too. Patient comes in, they were increasing the diuretics because of ascites. Patient was urinating more, comes a little hypotensive. You know, that's a perennial hint right there. Somebody comes with lactulose increases and comes with 7 bowel movements a day because of hepatic encephalopathy prevention. You know, things are very clear that you got to think it perennial states is the first option.
Okay, so this sounds pretty similar to a typical AKI workup. If you have a good history for prerenal, it's likely prerenal.
And sometimes the story is pretty good for ATN. For example, a patient who comes in with septic shock and has an AKI, that's likely going to be ATN.
Right. Those situations make sense. But the thing that trips me up is what are the things that just clue us in that this is hepatorenal syndrome going on?
Right. So let's unpack that, Treya. And let's start with something as simple as the vitals. In theory, a patient with HRS is in a very vasodilatory state, and we would expect the blood pressure to be lower than normal. Not low enough to the point that we're talking about shock, but just on the lower side.
Okay. Well, look at the vital signs immediately. Okay. If I have a blood pressure of 172 over 82, I mean, I know that that's not going to be HRS. It's just not possible. It doesn't fit.
Okay, so with a high blood pressure, hepatorenal syndrome's out.
Not so fast, Shreya. We don't want to be tricked. We don't want to be tricked into thinking that HRS can only happen with a low blood pressure. It's all about relatively low compared to the patient's normal.
If you look at the meta-analysis that we published in 2011, that we compile over 20 clinical trials of HRS, the mean, right? The average mean arterial pressure on arrival was 76 millimeters of mercury, 76. So you don't have to or necessarily have a MAP of 62 to think HRS.
Great. So just to put this into context, say we have a patient with, you know, MASLD who has complications in terms of portal hypertension, who's coming in with an AKI and their blood pressure is 120 over 80. But you look at the old clinic blood pressures and their blood pressure usually actually sits at 160 over 90, right? This should really raise concerns about hepatorenal syndrome.
Yeah. So even though a blood pressure of 120 over 80 is normal, in this sense, it's relatively low. After blood pressure, the next thing to do, of course, is look for signs of worsening portal hypertension. Because throwback to Pearl 1, HRS is all about portal hypertension.
I eyeball the patient, and I do think that the rubric of generally compensated, decompensated, or portal hypertension, no portal hypertension is very useful. So I look at the physical exam. So is this patient muscle wasted? Do they have a protuberant abdomen? Do they have spider angiomata? Do they have bulging flanks? Does this appear to be a decompensated patient? Then I think more likely this could be hepatorenal physiology at least.
for instance, documentation of spontaneous bacterial peritonitis. In the literature, is very clear that that's one of the most established precipitating factors for HRS. So I'm going to look for that. And then, is this patient coming from frequent paracentesis that they were monthly, now we're biweekly, now they're weekly? So that's telling me some progression of the portal hypertension.
All right, so whether it's on exam or chart review, we're going to look for signs of worsening portal hypertension. And then on the flip side, if we don't see signs of portal hypertension, the diagnosis can't be hepatorenal syndrome.
So far, we've just been talking about the big three of HRS, prerenal, and ATN. But it's always humbling to be reminded that it isn't just those three in the differential for AKI and cirrhosis.
I think the majority of the literature in HRS and AKI and cirrhosis has concentrated into the idea that it's a triad of prerenal, ATN, and HRS. And they have tried to sold us this story of a three-way path that there's only three options. Anywhere between 5, 10, or even 15% of your patients may have something else that is not any of those three. I take that very seriously because I feel like that's our role in nephrology, right? We don't want to miss a GN that could have a completely different approach. So most of the times, there will be a UA on record before we get consulted. And I'm going to look at the UA. There's any evidence of proteinuria, hematuria, leukocyturia. Those three things I'm going to look.
As a rule of thumb, in HRS, you would expect to see a bland UA. So no proteinuria, no red blood cells, no casts.
If I see the urinalysis showing those parameters, my next step is going to be go back to the history. Does this guy has hepatitis B, hepatitis C? Oh, look, there's a million viral loads of hepatitis B 2 weeks ago. Boom, my suspicion for hepatitis B associated GN is going to increase. And then we also know that patients with cirrhosis are predisposed to develop secondary IgA nephropathy. So that independently of hepatitis B and C, I have that in my radar.
So far, we have the big three of prerenal, ATN, and HRS. We have a new glomerular process. And then next on the differential, if you have a patient with really tense ascites, you should always think about abdominal compartment syndrome. And this is something that can usually be fixed with a large volume paracentesis.
Yeah, that reminds me of a good rule of thumb in these patients. It's always good to get a bladder scan, right? We don't want to go down a rabbit hole and miss a simple post-renal AKI.
There's one more feature that's really helpful in narrowing your differential diagnosis. That's sodium. In fact, it's so helpful, we're going to dedicate our entire next pearl to sodium.
Yeah, so before we move on to sodium, which I'm guessing is your favorite cation as a budding nephrologist, let's recap Pearl 2 on the differential of AKI and cirrhosis. And initially, you can think of it, you know, similar to our typical AKI workup, right? If the story is concerning for prerenal, if someone's having increased bowel movements due to lactulose, it's probably a prerenal AKI. If someone's coming in septic shock, probably ATN. And of course, don't forget about those post-renal causes of AKI that can also happen in a patient with cirrhosis.
And then what makes the special AKI on cirrhosis is we have to think about this other diagnosis, this HRS. And remember, it's really a AKI on portal hypertension. So that's what we're looking for. Signs of worsening portal hypertension, more frequent paracentesis, worsening ascites, SBP. And the opposite's also true. If there's no ascites, this isn't HRS. Period.
You do love that point. And then also if a patient has a history of hep B, hep C, if they have any blood or protein in their urine, we should also be thinking more about glomerulonephritis.
So in the reasoning process of what is causing that AKI in the patient with cirrhosis, I want to argue the most important diagnostic factor we need to talk about is sodium. Like most things in life, it always goes back to sodium.
Very, very cute. I agree. And this is one of my favorite points from the hyponatremia episode, which is the idea that these patients with decompensated cirrhosis, the people with portal hypertension, right, they have decreased effective circulating volume. So the body's going to be sensing that low effective blood volume, that it's not only going to turn on the RAS system, but also ADH. And in high states of ADH, what's that ADH going to do? It's going to cause us to hold on to free water, and all that excess free water is going to lead to our good friend hyponatremia.
Advanced cirrhosis usually is a state where the probability of severe hyponatremia increases, right? Sort of a compensated cirrhosis is not going to have a sodium of 118. That's typically a decompensated cirrhosis, a high ADH state. It's a high ADH state. So that's going to be significant hemodynamic derangement. If you have a creatinine that is 3.2 and a sodium is 132 versus a creatinine of 3.2 and a sodium of 118, you know, I'm going to, okay, the 118 guy sounds like he's just a more advanced portal hypertension, advanced cirrhosis state.
The point here is if you're intravascularly depleted enough to have HRS, by definition, you are also intravascularly depleted enough to have high ADH and therefore hyponatremia. So we can think of the low serum sodium as a correlate to worsening portal hypertension. And that's just the power of the serum sodium. We can get so much more information from the urine sodium.
Yeah, definitely. And then I guess in thinking about AKI, we often get a fractional excretion of sodium, aka the FeNA. But I don't know, is there any utility in getting that in portal hypertension? I mean, these patients, their urine sodium is always going to come back less than 20, right? That portal hypertension, the patient's always in this vasodilatory state, the RAS is cranked up, the body wants to retain as much sodium as possible. Urine sodium is always going to come back less than 20, right? I'm curious, should we just ignore that FeNA and just skip that part in the workup?
We need to shift the threshold way down to the point that the classic cirrhotic is going to have a low FeNA, but an HRS is usually extremely low, almost another order of magnitude low. So that's why when I get a urine sodium, I still like to get a urine creatinine to get a sense of the FeNA. And bottom line is that, yes, even ATN patients are going to have low FeNA, but it's probably going to be like a 0.6%, not 0.08%.
So let's back up. Where normally a FeNA of over 1% is consistent with intrinsic disease and under 1% is consistent with prerenal, in cirrhosis, we shift this entire framework. Every FeNA is going to be low, but for the AKI to be consistent with HRS, we want a FeNA not less than 1%, but really something like 0.1%.
Yeah. And let me just say it another way to make it stick. You know, I think we have to pay attention to the decimal point and the extra zero. So if we get a FeNA back for a patient who has portal hypertension and if the FeNA is 0.06%, yes, it can be low enough to be HRS. But if it comes back and it's 0.6% in a patient with portal hypertension, then it's not HRS and maybe ATN or something else. Again, we're talking about a whole magnitude of 10 difference.
To recap that, if the FeNA is less than 0.1%, it is virtually certain to be HRS. Something like a 0.2 or a 0.3, that doesn't rule HRS out, it doesn't rule it in. But once we're talking over 0.5%, now it's extremely unlikely to be HRS.
Yeah, and you know, I just thought about something. I used to work at a place where the lab, it would only come back, the urine sodium would only come back less than 20. It wouldn't give us a specific number like 5 or 9. So I imagine in those situations, it might be like impossible to calculate an accurate FeNA. So Noah, what do we do in those situations?
That's a great question, Shreya. And to kind of calm your nerves a little bit, this urine sodium can still be helpful. If that is the case with your lab, if the urine sodium is not less than 20, then HRS is ruled out. You will not have HRS with a urine sodium greater than 20.
Okay, so like we don't have the exact percentage, but you know, at least we have some threshold to rule out HRS with a urine sodium. So something, I guess, is better than nothing. I'm also thinking about the cases of people who are on diuretics. How do we interpret the urine sodium in these patients with portal hypertension?
And sometimes they tell me, well, the patient is on spironolactone. Well, let me tell you, if the patient is HRS, the kidneys are not going to care if you're on spironolactone. Right? You're just not going to respond to the point of having a urinary sodium of 40. Otherwise, the kidneys are fine at responding to the diuretic, right? So no, if a patient has a urinary sodium of 42, that is extremely inconsistent with HRS.
So in HRS, all those hormonal changes make the drive for sodium reabsorption so strong that even on a diuretic, which causes you to pee out sodium, the urine sodium will still be less than 20. That's how powerful HRS is. The kidney does not care about those diuretics.
That is a great point. And I guess the clinical takeaway here is that I don't have to wait until the diuretics are out of someone's system to interpret the urine sodium. So that's awesome. And so let's summarize all things about the sodium. In hepatorenal syndrome, we have a high ADH state. And so the serum sodium is going to be low. And then also in hepatorenal syndrome, because of RAS is on, that urine sodium will also be low.
And that urine sodium isn't just going to be low. It's going to be really low. We're talking about a FeNA less than 0.5%. And don't worry if the lab can only report a urine sodium less than 20. In that case, just make sure the urine sodium is less than 20 before you start thinking about HRS.
I am so excited to have Echo Core 500 Digital Stethoscope as a sponsor. I actually learned about them accidentally a year or so ago when I'd forgotten my stethoscope and my resident let me borrow his, and I just was like, wow, I've never heard heart sounds or lung sounds this clearly. You just get this extra level of confidence for those moments where you're asking, was that faint crackles? Was that an S3 gallop? And so that's because Echo's digital stethoscope amplifies sounds 40x, and then on top of that, it has noise cancellation so you can really hear with precision in a noisy ED or with a really loud roommate or other environments. Echo AI is also built in and helps you detect murmurs and AFib earlier. A cool thing also is that you can record that heart sound that you heard, share it later with your team or on a case presentation. And then you can really trust the diagnostic accuracy, so those who use Echo are twice as likely to catch heart disease. What I think is neat is that Echo 500 isn't just the digital stethoscope. You can actually also get an EKG tracing right on the app when you place an Echo 500 on a patient's chest. So no more waiting around trying to trace down the EKG machine on the floor. I trust Echo so much that I work with a team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/corium. Your purchase will be HSA and FSA eligible and may also qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you're going to detect heart and lung sounds more confidently. And if you don't, you can return it with a full refund. Go to echohealth.com/corium for $50 off plus a free chest cover. That's ekohealth.com/corium. And with that, let's get back into the episode. Here at Corium, we're talking about the real things that can help anyone who works in healthcare. And today we are talking about how the scrubs you wear, they can make a difference. I remember the first time I saw one of my colleagues walking into a sign-in room looking way more put together after a night shift, and I knew right then and there they were wearing FIGS. FIGS scrubs are made specifically for doctors, residents, students, and healthcare professionals like us. We're putting in long hours, and we need gear that can keep up and perform at our level. You have so much going on during any shift, and your scrubs is the last thing you want to think about. And that's why FIGS are lightweight, stretchy, and breathable. Plus, they have all those small touches that really have made me a true convert. The fit is clean, modern, super functional, tons of pockets, which I love for all the snacks, zippers that don't snag, and antimicrobial fabric to stay healthy while working in the clinic or in the hospital. You deserve better scrubs. You deserve FIGS. So head over to wearfigs.com and enter FIGSRX at the checkout for 15% off your first purchase. That's wearfigs.com, promo code FIGSRX for 15% off your first order. And with that, let's get back to the episode.
Now we get to the fun and controversial part of this episode, the official diagnosis of HRS.
And here we're going to talk about the idea of giving an albumin challenge. And this really comes from the 2021 guidelines to diagnose hepatorenal syndrome. And this was a checklist, kind of list of five different things. One, you need to have cirrhosis with ascites, right? That goes back to the idea of having some type of portal hypertension. The actual diagnosis of an AKI, the absence of shock, no recent nephrotoxic drugs, so no recent IV contrast. Also, no signs of structural kidney injury on ultrasound. And last but not least, no response in terms of the creatinine after 2 consecutive days of diuretic withdrawal, as well as plasma volume expansion with albumin.
I don't know about you, Shreya, but I don't think I've ever seen a patient who has no nephrotoxic meds. Yeah. They're all on antibiotics or NSAIDs or just got contrast in the ED for a CAT scan.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So the criteria is really hard to meet. But the general idea with this albumin challenge is to rule out prerenal. In prerenal disease, the creatinine should get better if you stop the diuretics and give albumin.
Right. And then if the creatinine doesn't go down with albumin for 2 days, then we've ruled out prerenal. And then we're really looking at, is this more of an HRS process or an ATN process? And here is where, after the 48 hours of albumin challenge, a urine sodium can help us differentiate between hepatorenal versus ATN.
If it is true HRS, the urine sodium will remain low because high aldosterone is driving the process. If it's true ATN, the urine sodium will be high because in ATN there's tubular injury and it's not aldosterone driving the AKI.
Touche. Good point. And here, just to say it out loud, because we've ruled out pre-renal with a 2 days of albumin challenge, things didn't get better. When you do get back that low urine sodium after 48 hours of albumin, it can only be HRS. No, this makes me think about this idea of a two-day albumin challenge. And I don't know about you, but I have had so many patients where it just didn't feel right. And I'm wondering, this day and age, do we have to give 2 days worth of albumin?
And that brings us to the controversial part. This kind of one-size-fits-all approach has problems. So there's been a movement to change the way we diagnose HRS. And there's two major changes.
In 2024, in March, we published this. So there's a big meeting we had in San Diego, a group of intensivists, hepatologists, and nephrologists. Let's try to revisit this definition. And the conclusion was to remove all those criteria and replace it by a statement that says that HRS should be diagnosed in the absence of a strong evidence of any other explanation. That's it. Obviously, a patient comes with fluid losses by history, you give him albumin and it gets better. Boom, that's pre-renal. That's very simple. What would be strong evidence of ATN? Urinary sodium above 20 on arrival, that's already strong evidence against HRS. That it is FeNO above 0.7, 0.8%. That is too high. That is strong evidence of ATN already.
So to reiterate, the first major change is that HRS is no longer diagnosed by that checklist. The way to diagnose HRS is just if there's an absence of strong evidence against any other explanation. That is it.
Awesome. And then to recap, we do have some labs and objective clues that can clue us in that HRS is not going on.
So what would be strong evidence against HRS? We've already talked about a lot of these. A urine sodium greater than 20. That's more likely ATN. That's not HRS. If the FeNO is over 0.5, that's not HRS. If the story sounds pre-renal, that's probably pre-renal. So we should treat it as pre-renal and not talk about HRS.
What else is a strong evidence of against HRS? Patient comes with a serum sodium of 144. What? That's not HRS. How is that going to be possible, right? Again, those are not going to be on your definition when you go to UpToDate, but I'm just giving you, answering your question. Those are the things that, to me, have now been replaced by this bold statement that in the absence of strong evidence of an alternative explanation.
So to reiterate, in classic HRS, we should not be seeing normal high serum sodium. And why is that? As a throwback, the kidneys are sensing low volume in hepatorenal syndrome, ADH is up, and that ADH is going to contribute to some degree of hyponatremia.
One other thing that's really helpful is urine microscopy. Specifically, greater than 10 muddy brown casts per field is very likely to be ATN and strong evidence against HRS.
Yeah, and then it's important to note that in real life, sometimes it's not always this clear. The urine sodium sometimes is low, but then there's also some muddy brown casts. It's a really hard call between ATN versus HRS. And I think in a lot of these situations, we do our best to make our best guess.
Yeah, Shreya, HRS is tough. Differentiating between HRS and ATN, sometimes you're not going to know. And that's why we're here doing this podcast to try to help out.
Yeah, no, definitely grateful.
Let's recap Pearl 4. HRS should no longer be diagnosed by the formal checklist. The diagnosis has been replaced by a statement that HRS is the absence of strong evidence of any other diagnosis.
Yes. So now, does this mean we don't have to give the albumin challenge every single time?
And that, Shreya, is a great segue to Pearl 5. And this brings us to the second major change. It is no longer mandatory to give every patient 48-hour albumin challenge.
Thank God. It just felt so wrong to do in some patients.
We have a patient that comes in that was going to the hepatology clinic for frequent paracentesis and was requiring, as I described earlier, you know, first was once every 6 weeks, now is every 2 weeks. And now it's coming every week for paracentesis. And shows up to the emergency room because the wife look at her husband and is like, you look like a balloon about to explode. And they come to you in the ED and they said that they have gained 13 kilograms despite the paracentesis and despite the diuretics. And you get an x-ray and it has hydrothorax and it's got peripheral edema all the way to the hip and ascites and tense abdominal wall edema. How on earth are you going to give albumin challenge to that patient? You know, think about it. So this is what he have been telling us historically, and this is just not an appropriate approach to just put everybody on the same bucket. Essentially, give albumin, close your eyes, let's come back in 48 hours. Did you get better? No, that's not the approach. So my approach to albumin is, in the presence of a clinical history that suggests volume depletion, or in the absence of elements that suggest ongoing hypervolemia, go for the challenge, right? And essentially, it looks dry, sounds dry, give albumin. If the patient is overloaded visibly to you, stay away from albumin. If you're kind of in a gray zone, you're not sure, go ahead. It's probably safe to try it.
Okay, so the takeaway is, if you have a patient who has cirrhosis coming in with an AKI and their story is pre-renal, yeah, sure, give them albumin. But if the patient looks volume overloaded, you're worried about respiratory compromise, albumin isn't going to help them.
About 8 to 11% of patients who get albumin with cirrhosis have flash pulmonary edema, and that's often deadly, you know, whether it be treated for sepsis or whatever you're doing.
And a quick caveat to that statistic of 8 to 11% of people developing flash pulmonary edema is that this population was in patients with cirrhosis with sepsis, not HRS. So a little bit different, but the point is that albumin doesn't come without risk.
Exactly. We really can't just give out albumin like candy to every patient with AKI. And we will talk a lot more about this in part two next week.
And so knowing your patient's intravascular volume status before you give them extra fluids, I think is the right next move. And so I think it's reasonable to try albumin if you're not sure or if you don't see signs of volume overload. But I think it's a little bit riskier and maybe even dangerous to just give albumin to everybody.
It definitely helps multiple people agree and challenge that dogma of giving albumin for 2 days in everyone with questionable hepatorenal syndrome.
It's also really good to hear, even our experts say, sometimes it's a really hard call whether to give albumin or not. All you could do is make your best guess on what the patient's intravascular volume status is.
Yeah, definitely. And so I guess if we do go ahead and give albumin to a patient that we might not be sure, do they have hepatorenal syndrome? Is this pre-renal or something else is at play? I'm curious, do we have to wait that full 48 hours before we call it HRS and possibly start treatment that could really help them?
What we said is you give albumin to a patient today. Creatinine is 2.2 and the next day is 2.3 or 2.4 or 2.5. Are you going to tell me that after giving 100 grams of albumin and the creatinine went up, you're going to give a second day and it's going to be the inflection point is going to come down? No. Now, if the patient had a creatinine 2.1 and you gave albumin, it came down to 1.9, of course, give it another day and give it another day and give it maybe 72 hours, maybe whatever it takes to get the resolution of the AKI. But the idea is that you need 48 hours to determine if albumin is going to work. I don't agree with that at all. So I wanted to mention that because that has come out in some of the GI journals, and I wasn't really agreeing with that.
Those trends in creatinine are really helpful. So if the creatinine the next day doesn't budge at all, and we gave a really aggressive albumin dose, then we should probably think about HRS on the sooner side. And this is important because HRS has a very specific treatment. That treatment will be the entire focus of the second part of this podcast next week.
Awesome. So let's recap all things about diagnosing HRS. I think we learned in our last pearl, the rules have become less rigid, and we now need to prove that there isn't an alternate diagnosis. And to clarify, yes, there is a role for albumin, and it'll help us, you know, treat pre-renal AKI in patients with cirrhosis, but we don't have to wait the full 2 days to see if it works or not. If the AKI is not getting better, then you're left with, is this hepatorenal syndrome or is it ATN? Two things that are managed completely differently. And it's going to be the urine sodium that can help us distinguish between the two. In hepatorenal syndrome, we're going to expect a low urine sodium, right? Aldosterone's at play. In ATN, though, we have tubular injury and the kidneys aren't going to reabsorb sodium, and we're going to get a urine sodium greater than 20 in ATN.
And that is a wrap for today.
And if you found this episode helpful, our ask is to share this with one other colleague, your team, someone else who might also get a good aha from this, because HRS can be really tough. And stay tuned for our next episode on all things hepatorenal syndrome treatment.
I want to thank our reviewers, Dr. Tapper and Dr. Belcher. And as always, opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliate institutions. Thank you and take care.
I feel like you're yelling at people sometimes. No, just help us. Help us non-nephrologists. You're like, people are just up and just writing AKI on cirrhosis, hepatorenal syndrome, and they are compensated. All these people, nobody's decompensated. They don't have splenic, you know, whatever you see on ultrasound.
Okay.
Sorry, just be a little
gentle. No, that was great.